Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to the Fighting on Film podcast, the podcast all about classic and obscure war movies, from the Normandy landings to the days of chivalry and swords. If it's been captured on film, we're going to try and cover it. I'm Robbie of RM Military History.
I'm Matthew Moss of Historical Firearms and the Armourer's Bench.
Hello, welcome back to Fighting on Film. This week we embark on Operation Delta Force December. To kick off this action-packed month, we are joined by the film's director, Sam Furstenberg, director of cult classics such as American Ninja, Avenging Force, American Samurai, Riverbend, and Delta Force 3, The Killing Game. Sam, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you.
Pleasure to be with you, and it's nice that you invited me to this show. Since it's the first time I'm doing a podcast regarding this movie.
Oh yeah, I bet.
Usually I'm interviewed about American Ninja. That's the most popular. But this is the first time I'm interviewed about Operation Delta Force. So I'm happy to be here.
Oh, fantastic! That's fantastic. So we usually cover production ourselves, but since we have you with us, Sam, could you give us like a brief rundown of how the film came about, you know, any interesting stories about the setting up of the movie?
Right. You know, I started my career with a company which was called Canon Film.
Yeah.
In Canon Film, the most famous stuff that we did was, of course, the Ninja movies. Revenge of the Ninja, Ninja 3, American Ninja number one. And I also directed for them a dance movie, Breaking to Electric Boogaloo. And then the company dissipated. The company went bankruptcy, disappeared from the face of this earth. Canon was also famous for the Delta Force movie, Chuck Norris.
Yes.
This was the big hit for Canon, the two Delta Force movies. And then the company disappeared, and another company came on the heel of the company. Same people, more or less. I think it was called Global Film, I think. And they wanted to do, they had the right to do a sequel to Delta Force. So they hired me to do Delta Force number 3. Chuck Norris was not anymore in the formula. And this company disappeared, Global Film disappeared. And during the days of Canon, I directed the movie American Ninja number 2 in South Africa. It was done in South Africa. And the company that helped the production was called New Image, or at the time was New Metro. New Metro was people who knew the people of Canon. They were friends. The heads of New Metro and the heads of Canon were friends. And for some financial reasons, we were filming the movie American Ninja Number 2 in South Africa. When those two companies that I mentioned earlier disappeared, the people of New Metro created a production company which was called New Image. Later, New Image produced many, many movies. And they called me in to direct a movie for them. The name of the movie was Cyber Cop with David Bradley. And I started to work with the company. I directed many movies for this company, New Image, Cyber Cop number 2 and others. And one day they approached me. It was not my initiative. They approached me. They wanted to do kind of an imitation of Delta Force, which was so successful for Canon. So they wanted to duplicate the success of Canon. And they wanted to do... they could not use the title Delta Force because most of the Canon movies went to MGM when there was a bankruptcy. The company ended in bankruptcy and most of the movies went to MGM, to Warner Brothers, big companies. And I think Delta Force, the title Delta Force, they couldn't use anymore because it was registered with one of those companies. And so they came up with this idea, Operation Delta Force. It's very hard to stop somebody from making a movie with the name, with the title Delta Force, but you have to change it a little bit. Mm. So it was the idea of the company. I did not initiate the idea. We want to do something similar. We'll call it Operation Delta Force. And the script was already written. When I was commissioned, when I was asked to direct the movie, the script was already written. Now, by then, the company have moved from South Africa to Hollywood, the offices. But they still had studios. They had studios in South Africa, in Johannesburg. And that's where we did the Cyber Cop movie, the two Cyber Cop movies. So they wanted to utilize the studios that they had. It was a primitive film studio. It was not elaborated. Nothing like England or Hollywood. Nothing like London or Hollywood. So they wanted to utilize it. So the script was written about the issue was Africa. The locale was Africa. And the issue was the Ebola virus, which at the time was a big news at the time. And that's how the movie came to life. Yeah. And eventually we went to South Africa and we did it.
Yeah. We made it. Do you know what budget was? Because it's one thing we found by trying to research this movie. We just couldn't find a budget anywhere.
Well, you know, one of the reasons that they were filming in South Africa, because at the time it was an advantage. There was an advantage with the exchange rate between the rand and the dollar. So it was called all kind of, and they had some local investors, banks, etc., financial institute. I'm not in this in this field of filmmaking or financing.
Sure. Yeah.
So, but this was the reason they were shooting in South Africa, because A, they had some filming equipment. They had the premises, the place to shoot. And it was advantageous to shoot using rands rather than dollars. So the only people who got paid, let's say dollars, are the actors and myself. All the other crew and equipment and everything were paid with rands. So I cannot tell you the real budget, the equivalent, but I would say it's around $1 million, more than $1 million, something, $1.5 million when you translate it to American dollars.
Right. Fair enough. I think you did well with what you had.
Yeah. So the schedule was nice. The schedule was good. It was an 8-week schedule. So there was no, you know, two units. We had all the cameras and all the equipment we wanted. So it's a small budget, but the means of filming, the means of productions were good.
What was it like? You know, you'd worked in South Africa before. What was it like working in just post-apartheid South Africa? And obviously, because a lot of the plot of the film is based around that far right element that wants a white South Africa, that the screenwriter came up with.
So I will explain. When we went to do American Ninja number 2, it was right at the edge of the kind of the end of the apartheid. Mm. It was not yet totally abolished, not yet, but it was at the edge. When I arrived to do American Ninja number 2, it was the time when they stopped issuing different identity cards for different races. Prior to this, there were three different identity cards. It was white, black, and colored. When I came, it was there was only one. They were issuing only one identity card with no race. Okay, but we still felt the apartheid, you know, of course, and we still felt the racial tension, etc. But officially, it was over. But the government did not change yet. It was still a white government when we came to American Ninja. Of course, we came back. Then there was the revolution. Nelson Mandela took over. When we came for Cyborg Cup number one, the atmosphere was already totally different. Cyborg Cup number two, by the time we did the Operation Delta Force, there was no more official apartheid at all. No, you know, the government was already, the National African Party was in charge. So, the crew, even back then, the crew was always mixed. Black Africans and white Africans together, working together. So on the set, among the film crew, you couldn't feel this. And you know, one of the heroes of the American Ninja was Steve James, which was a black American, and he was uncomfortable going there. So once I was there in Johannesburg, I called him and said, "Steve, come over. This no, you will not feel anything. There is no feeling." But of course, you know, we didn't live in the, we are not local. We can't feel the nuances, the little nuances. Yeah,
exactly. A fascinating perspective on it, though.
But overall, there was no, by the time we did the Operation Delta Force, there was no more racial separation at all.
No. So in terms of a little bit more about the production, I've got some things here. So the cinematography is by Yossi Wine. He would go on to direct the sequel to Operation Delta Force 2 Mayday in 1998. He also was a cinematographer on Cyborg Cop, Danger Zone and Navy SEALs. Is released on the 16th of September 1997 in the US. It was a HBO home premiere and then it went straight to video. And I have a retro review for us this week. Very rarely I get to do a review in front of films. This is a first on the show, I think. So our retro review this week comes from TV Guide from 1997. I've cut it down for ease, but it follows as this. Viewers of Operation Delta Force can snooze at any point and not miss anything essential plot-wise. The Special Forces Adventure, which premiered on HBO and then was released directly to home video, is for action junkies only. Such fans will only be miffed when the prodigious action sequences are interrupted to deal with McKinney's sexist belligerence towards a female comrade or Lang's trumped-up animosity towards Tipton, elements obviously added to space out the mayhem. There we are.
I would say it's an accurate description. I will tell you, not to make excuses or anything like this, I inherited the script. The script was given to me. And many times, as a director, when I get a script, I have enough leeway to change a little bit, to work with the writer, sometimes hire a different writer for what they call in Hollywood polish the script. And so on. Here, there was a unique situation. The script was written by the two executive producers who produced the movie. So it was Danny Lerner and Trevor Shaw. They wrote the script. So it was, I was in a tight, uncomfortable situation of telling them, you know, I don't like this, I don't like that, because if they would tell me, we like it, what can I do? They are the producers of the movie. In other movies, usually after writing, we didn't have the writer with us anymore, and the producers didn't care, you know, let's say I'm doing a Revenge of the Ninja, producers don't care if I change the script or not. But here, in this case, it was awkward situation, it was tight, because those two guys are the producers, and they are the writer. And both of them from South Africa. You know, they came from South Africa. By then, the offices were in Hollywood already, as I told you. They moved the offices to Hollywood. But still, they were high on this whole ideas that may telling a story about Africa and on and on. Now, also the company, the way it was, Canon was the same thing. Canon and New Image had this kind of the same philosophy. we need a lot of explosions, we need a lot of helicopters, we need a lot of, so we can sell it easily. So my feeling today, retrospectively, of course, speaking, that it was pushed way too much into the action side of making a movie. We always had formula when we made movies, and this was, as a director of action movies, this was my formula. 50% action, 50% story. I always believe that if you give the audience, the action audience, action lover audience, if you give them less of 45 minutes action in a movie, it's a cheat. You're cheating them. But I re-reviewed this movie, Operation Fallout. I'll tell you, there is more, way more than 45 minutes action. So as a consequence, there was not enough minutes, let's say, minutes in the movie to develop the character or to develop. And so, you know, if you think about, if you're looking at American Ninja, or the relationship between Michael Dudikoff and Steve James, the love story between Michael Dudikoff and Judy Aronson, there is enough time to develop those. Therefore, enhance the empathy of the audience to the character. And here in Operation Delta Force, a lot of military action, really a lot of military action, less of developing the characters in a way, or developing the element of what is on stake, what is at stake, what is, why are we, it's not developed enough. And therefore it diminished a little bit from the emotional involvement of the audience in the story, how much they care. So what the review that you read is pretty fair, I would say.
I wouldn't say that it's necessarily a bad thing. I think the film very much knows what it is. And I think if you go into it looking for an action movie, you're going to be more than happy. And I don't even think that the fact that obviously it isn't that 50-50 spread that you talked about, I think we get enough context of who these people are. And the film does it in a very economical, but also pretty decent way of explaining, like, Tipton's had a bit of controversy, friendly fire incident. He's killed Lang's brother. There's some misogyny going on. The baddie's really bad. I think it all gets laid out really nicely, obviously the lean's a little bit more to the action side of things. But damn, does this film, it really does get everything in. I made a note at the end. I was going to say it at the end of the show, but it honestly, you get a hostage rescue, buggies, boats, train assault, village set piece, Ebola outbreak, halo jump, boat assault, everything. It's all there.
For that, I'm with Matt on that one. I think reappraising something from, it's not 20 odd years ago now, but like it's streamlined. I think now if you produce something like that for a Netflix, for a Prime Video, and you run unashamedly saying, look, this is an action film, this is exactly what you're going to get, I think it really flows quite well. We say a lot on the show, you can leave your brain at the door and you can sit down with a snack and a beer or whatever, and it's just an enjoyable watch. Like, it's not, you know what you're getting, and I love it for that. Me and Matt say a lot that, and I was going to say in final thoughts, but I'll echo it now. I'll probably say it later as well. This art, this type of filmmaking, this home premiere, straight to video way of doing things that was so prevalent back in the late 90s, 80s, early 1000s, it's been lost. And I love these movies for that. I love that they are just unashamedly the genre, and with all the cliches and everything else that comes with it. But that's why they're so good. You know, I want to gorge on them almost, because they're just so enjoyable.
I grew up on my diet of movies when I was a kid. I was 7 years old, 8 years, nine. This was 1957, 1958. I saw a movie every week. I saw two movies. I was a little kid. There was in my neighborhood, there was a theater. We went, you know, double. We saw a lot of World War II movies. Obviously, at the time, you know, it was 57, 58, 59. So what we saw was Westerns, mainly Westerns and war movies. Western and war movies. And Westerns are also war movies in a different way, you know, a different type of a war movie. But this military. So I was always in love. And at the beginning of my career as a director, I said, well, one day I really want to do a Western, which never happened. And one day I want to do a military movie. I really want to do a war movie, a military movie. So as far as Western, I just got to, in South Africa, in American Ninja number 2, we have a bar, brawl in a bar, like in a saloon. A fight. So that's as far as I went. But to satisfy my will to make a war movie, I got two chances, Delta Force number 3 and Operation Delta Force. So I deluge. I did as much as I directed as much. I packed in as much as I can to satisfy my my own desire to make such this type of movies.
I mean, it shows. I think it really shows. So Matt, maybe you should give us a rundown of the cast quickly.
Absolutely. And Sam, if you have any stories about the cast, do jump in. So obviously the lead is Ernie Hudson, best known for Ghostbusters. He's been in Family Business recently, Quantum Leap as well at the moment. He's also been in Dirty Dozen, Fatal Mission, which we covered last December.
That links back to last December. That's why. That's one of the reasons that this month came about, was because I noticed it was on his credits list. Gets in the back pocket till now.
He's great in this. I think he's fabulous in this. Jeff Fahey, Lost, Wyatt Earp, Only the Brave. Robert Stewart plays Sparks. Frank Segarino plays McKinney. We got the Final Mission, Train to Kill, Striker, Warhead, Shadow Chaser, lots of great cult movies. Joe Lara playing the bad guy, Johan Nash. Again, he was in Warhead. He was in a Tarzan show in the 90s, and he was also in Operation Delta Force 4 as well. We'll be mentioning him again later this month, I'm sure. Then we've got Todd Jensen, who played Hutch, and he was in Operation Delta Force 2 as Sergeant Lombardi, and Operation Delta Force 5 as Bob Johnson. So he's in three of the movies in three different characters as well.
And he was in Cyber Cop, Todd Jensen.
He was, and Warhead, and he was also an extra in an episode of CI5, The New Professionals, Rob.
Wow.
Yeah, I've got that in there for you.
The lesser talked about professional series.
Indeed,
So here it was, what happened. First, there was the script. The script was given to him. The company, New Image, they had relationship with Jeff Fahey because they made another, earlier before they made another movie with him, with Eric Roberts, I think. Was something about the waterfall. I forgot the name of it. But they already had, already had relationship with Jeff Fahey. So they spoke with him. I was not involved, So many times a director is involved in the casting, but in most of the cases, director is not involved in the star, in the one or two stars, because those are deals which are made between the producer and the agency, and the people who will buy the movie and the distributor. So getting the star of a movie is sometimes it's a financial decision, I would say, business decision.
Definitely.
Rather. So anyway, they had relationship with Jeff Fahey. So we spoke with him, they spoke with him, I met with him. Okay, he agreed to do this movie. That Ernie Hudson, they did not have relationship. But I suggested him for some, I don't remember how, I suggested that Jeff Fahey, I think by that time, Steve James already died.
Right.
He died very young, very early, Steve. And so anyway, so they approached him through the channels, through the agency, they found the agency. He came to meet me, I met with him. We liked each other a lot. He came aboard. Okay, he agreed. Frank Zagarino, I knew very well. I was friends with Frank Zagarino. Frank Zagarino was part of our group of, I did not direct him prior to this, but he was part of the group of the action crowd, Michael Dooley.
We can see it from his credits. He's
the
in
same
that
type
sphere,
of movies.
Isn't he?
So he was in New Image, and I knew him. I used to go to his house. We were friends with Frank Zagarino. So I knew him already. Joe Lara made movies in Canon. So he knew Boaz Davidson. He was in, and Boaz Davidson is one of the producers of Operation Delta Force. So Boaz Davidson brought in Joe Lara because he made with him the movie a prior movie, an action movie also, that Boaz Davidson directed. So right. Boaz Davidson brought in Joe Lara, and you know, it was fantastic. I brought in Rob Stewart. I directed. Rob Stewart was the star of a television show called The Sweating Bullet. And I directed one season of Sweating Bullet.
So I
was friendly with Rob Stewart. He was the star.
Cool.
It had two names, this television series, Tropical Heat and Sweating Bullet.
I've seen it called Rob Stewart.
Todd Johnson, I already knew. And he's a South African. Todd Johnson lives in Johannesburg. So he was in Cyber Cup number one, Cyber Cup number two. Okay, bring him along. He's in. So he was in. So kind of more or less, that's how the cast came together. Okay. Now, you know, sometimes, interesting, just from a gossip point of view, sometimes you have a cast that they really gel together. They're really, I mean, they off-screen, they became friends, you know. Mm. And it happened to me a lot. Michael Dudikoff and Steve James became good friends, and Judy Aronson. In this case, in our case right here, Jeff Fahey and Ernie Hudson, which are the lead story, the whole most of the story, but they did not become good friends. I mean, they were not very friendly to each other.
Oh dear!
Plot, though, doesn't it? It can reflect it on screen.
On the screen. You can see it on the screen exactly, and it was to a point. The Jeff, you know, they have trailers. Actors have the trailers when they don't.
Yeah.
So Jeff always asks, put my trailer 100 foot away from the set. I want to be by myself over there. So he always had his trailer far away from all of us, from the set.
Wow.
So he wouldn't. But then, you know, toward the end, everybody, it kind of became a group toward the end. Yeah, Frank Zagarino, a nice guy. Joe Lara, kind of a loner, you know, off screen, outside. But Rob and all of us, usually we stay in hotels together. You know, we go to location, we stay in hotels together. So it happens a lot that in the weekend we'll eat together, we'll go to a restaurant together afterward. So this was how it came about, the cast. Ah, and one more, what's his name?
Hal Holbrook.
So he was not cast right away. We went to South Africa. We didn't have somebody for this part. And it was only 2 days shooting, only 2 days of filming. So the company, but they knew that they wanted to sneak in somebody with a name, with a recognizable name. So while we were already in Africa filming, I got the message there. We got Hal Holbrook to do this. Whoa, that's so sorry. He's an Academy Award actor.
Yeah.
Okay, so he came. He got all the respect, etc. But only 2 days, and he left us. He was there only 2 days.
It's so bizarre seeing him in a military role. I'm not used to that. So it was. It's a nice little.
Does it well though?
Yeah, well, he does it well. Yeah,
he'd been in Under Siege '86 and Behind Enemy Lines, and he'd been in a nuclear war movie as well. So he'd done a couple of things military-esque.
And you know, Joe Lara does not speak really Afrikaans, and there are lines in Afrikaans, so they had to teach every line by line how to pronounce it, and his few lines on the radio when he talks in Afrikaans, He fit the bad guy. He was good.
He's
nailed it as an antagonist of the movie.
He's definitely big bad. Yeah, it's very good.
Yeah, there was Natasha Sutherland as well, who I believe is a South African actor.
Yeah, she's a South African.
Yeah, and she's been in a couple of things.
There was also this one guy who dies in the jeep. He's a South African actor. Natasha was a South African actor. All the generals, supposedly American generals, etc., they are South African actors with the American accent. I think one of them was American who lives in South Africa. But all of the actors, all the other generals, everybody, except the one that we have mentioned now, everybody was local.
Holbrook's aide does a very good, well, I say good, but like Southern American accent.
Yeah.
throughout, and that you can add that. Yep.
Okay. I like it.
I don't remember if we dubbed any of them later or not. I don't remember, but I remember that one of them was an American actor who lived in South Africa.
Mm.
And he was training them to do the American accent. the all those generals who sit around the table.
Yeah,
all of them are.
I think we've done the cast. I think now we should move into the Alley Tally and talk about some of the kit and equipment on show in the.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Movie.
It's time for Alley Tally on Fighting on Film.
I know before we started recording, Sam, you asked me to ask you about the military advisor, and we're all very excited to hear about this chap.
So this is actually the greatest anecdote story about this movie is the military advisor. On the movie Delta Force, I was not the original director. The original director was, what's his name, from Australia. Nice director, good director from Australia. I remember the name in a second. And I was recruited in the first day of shooting. Something happened there. I don't know exactly, some relationship issues. So
on Delta Force 3, Sam?
Delta Force number 3, not this movie.
Got you.
Delta Force 3. I was in Israel. It was filmed in Israel. Delta Force 3 was still in Israel. There was no Chuck Norris, but there was Mike Norris. I already knew Mike Norris. I was friendly with Mike Norris. Mike Norris was almost the American Ninja. In the last minute, the process of casting American Ninja, finally we decided on Michael Dudikoff. But Mike was contender. Mike was there. So I knew Mike Norris. So I was there making another movie in Israel, completely another movie for the same company. And they called me. I finished the filming of the other movie. It's called The Day We Met. It's actually a comedy. And they called me. I knew all the people involved. Actually, Chris Pierce, he was from England. He was the head of production at Canon. And then he became the head of production of Global, Chris Pierce. And he called me. It was in the weekend. He said, we need you Sunday morning. In Israel, they start filming. The week starts on Sunday.
Yeah.
So I jumped into the... I came in the first day of shooting, and it's a heavy military movie. Now, I served in the military in Israel, but nothing special. I was not in any special forces, just infantry and engineering corps, and nothing special. I was never involved in any action. Nothing happened in my 3 years in the military. Nothing happened to me in terms of excitement. So I know basics. I know what guns mean. I know what mortar means. Basics, what is a rocket, tank. But I don't have experience really in a special operation and those kind of forces. And then, so I come on the first day of shooting and we start to shoot a scene. And after a few hours of that, I realize there is no military advisor on the set.
Mm.
I'm alone. I'm by myself. Okay, go ahead. Make a military movie about Delta Force, about special commando operation. What do I know about commando operation? other than what
it's
I saw in the movie.
It's refreshing to hear a director say something like that, I think.
Yeah.
I see movies, but otherwise, so all my knowledge is from movies, not from real. But saying that in Israel, every crew member is a general, so to speak. every crew member, the prop master or the lighting, so many of them. And we had, a good stunt crew from Australia. So they had some knowledge. But when it came to questions over how do you talk in the radio, I don't know the minute, the little details of commando operation, I didn't know, nobody knew. So I got some advice from whoever on the crew had enough in Israel, everyone served in the military. So a few of them, and Guy Norris was the guy, Guy Norris from Australia was the stunt coordinator. Not related to the Norris family, Mike Norris. And so they knew, so I was gathering information. How do you operate? How do you walk with a gun? How do you... Okay. When I was hired to do this operation, Delta Force, so my first meeting, I met with the producers, Danny Lerner, Avi Lerner. I said, my first request, I will direct this movie. Okay, but you must hire military advisor. I'm not a military expert. Please, I need somebody to guide me.
Yeah.
I know how to direct movies. I don't know how to direct war operation. So they agreed. They understood it. And looking around, and I don't remember how we found this guy, Eric Simmel. You will see his name in the
credits. Yeah, I saw it on the credits. Yeah.
The military director. He was a SEAL. In the SEALs, in the American SEALs. Right. And he, writer, movie scriptwriter, and he did not write this script, but he was a writer and a military SEAL. So I met with Eric Simmel, and now we are talking different language. Now we are talking about a different level. Eric read the script and made notes, and I said, and right away, we are still in Hollywood before we go to South Africa. He's, he's American from the Navy. So American Navy. So he said, let me take you to a warehouse where we find the right gear. So first of all, we went to a warehouse of weapon and equipment for rental, for movies. So he showed me the right guns because he was in a commando unit. He was in such a unit in the SEALs. So he showed me the right guns, the right outfit, the right glasses that they have to wear. And the way they talk with each other and the way they behave and the way they walk. Do you walk in a line? Do you walk in parallel? He knew all of it. But the first thing was the equipment. So we went and to the right few warehouses where they rent equipment. So either some of them we rented and we shipped to South Africa. And this was also problematic. Shipping weapon to South Africa was problematic by itself. But some of it was duplicated in South Africa. We only had, and he knew all the right insignia and the uniform and exactly whatever symbol goes in every pocket and every shoulder, etc., and so on and so on, and the diving equipment. And he came with me to South Africa. Now this was a different story for me, because now I could direct with ease, and every question I ask, I turn around to Eric. Eric, how do we do it? Oh, Eric, prepare the troop for tomorrow. Tomorrow we have the so-and-so scene. Or next Tuesday, go ahead and prepare them. Show them how they move and how they walk and how they... this is one of the reasons when you watch Operation Delta Force, it looks believable. It has this feeling of that's how special units operate.
I like that.
He showed me. And those vehicles... those jeeps, open jeep was his idea, was Eric's idea.
Yeah, Delta Force patrol vehicle.
Delta Force, this was Eric's idea, and he brought them in. The truth that the movie is a little bit outdated when you look at the equipment. I'm looking nowadays, the weapon nowadays is unbelievable compared to and what was, we're talking only 30 years ago,
Yeah. So for me and Matt, in terms of the kit and equipment. That's something we really enjoyed.
So even the radio equipment they're using, it looks like medieval nowadays.
There's a bit where Ernie pulls out one of those really chunky old mobile phones in the in the lab sequence. Yeah, I love that.
I know.
I had a very similar first phone when I was
of
a
course,
kid.
All of us. Yeah, sure. But the radio, the equipment, the guns, etc., it looks like compared to what they have today.
But there's so much there, though. There's so much in there that's really cool stuff.
The other one more problem in the movie, I must say, it sticks out to me. We had a sequence with the train. It's nice. It's exciting. The bridge, we found a fantastic location in South Africa. This huge,
amazing
tall
location
bridge where the two trains, but we couldn't get modern train. The production couldn't get the higher real modern, so we have two steam engines.
I love that. I thought that was great. Like, it's so good.
There's your Western again, Sam. That's the Western.
Yeah, there you go.
This bridge, the train on the bridge is a Western. It's absolutely right. It has the look of a Western. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
So that's one more. This is one little detail of the old locomotives rather than having modern.
So some of the things we picked out when we were watching. Just the varied amount of weapons that are in the movie. So you've got your Delta Force guys with their silenced MP5 SDs. You've got Ernie Hudson running around with a captured Walther MP submachine gun, which Matt was very excited to see because they're very,
see it very often. Nice.
No, you like don't.
It. As I said, a lot of it is because of Eric. Now, one more story is the helicopter.
Oh yeah,
the helicopters. You know, and the low-budget action production companies, they love helicopters. An helicopter exploding. You know, you'll see it in any action, low-budget action, independent movie, exploding helicopter. But anyway, there is in the movie this huge white helicopter. It's a Russian helicopter.
Mm.
ME-8 or ME-5. I don't remember the number. ME-5. How did it came about it? You know, there was a war in Angola prior, 10 years earlier, before.
Yeah.
And Angola was communist. South Africa was fighting Angola. You know, South Africans were fighting Angolan's guerrillas.
Mm-hmm.
And Russia was on the Angolan side. So Russia supplied to Angola all those old, we can say old helicopters. They are huge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And hundreds and hundreds of them. And then the war came to an end between South Africa and Angola. And Russia didn't want them back. So in Angola, they were parked, and Angola had nothing to do with it, those. So there was, the way I was told, there was like a big field with 400 those MI helicopters just standing there. Wow. Nobody knew what to do. So the UN bought it from Angola for humanitarian use. And they were cheap. They were trying just to get rid of them. So the production company got one of them, but nobody knows how to fly it. There are other two helicopters in the movie, Western helicopters.
Yeah.
I don't know the names, but you had the South African pilots who knew how to operate them, but nobody knew how to operate the Russian helicopter, this huge. So they imported two pilots from Russia, came. You know,
wow.
Somebody had a contact either in Russia or Bulgaria, one of those countries, Soviet countries, and two pilots came. A pilot and an assistant pilot came from just for this movie. They spoke English. The pilot spoke English, and wow, he came to the helicopter. It's even in a Russian terms, it's an old helicopter, and the helicopter is made. You know, the shell of the helicopter is made out of a material, not aluminum. It's like burlap. Yeah,
wow,
the structure is aluminum, but when you touch the shell, it's a burlap. It's a piece of material.
Did you actually blow up the helicopter? You know, in the scene where Ernie blows it up, was that the helicopter that blew up?
Yes,
was it that cheap?
But what blows
was
up
it
is
a model?
Mock-up.
Okay,
we didn't
I was
going to
say.
Real one.
Yeah, I was going to say, are they that cheap that you could just blow it up?
The art department have built a mock-up that we blow up.
Right.
But then this And this helicopter does not fly. You know, there is a scene that Ernie Hudson crawls underneath. He opens a little and the fuel comes out. This helicopter does not fly on benzene or diesel. It flies on kerosene. Very primitive. So that's why it was safe to open it. Because you will not open with a real gasoline, with a benzene, with a... And this kerosene does not light up. So that's why it was safe to open it and to let it... the pilot... And there is a section over there, and the pilot came, you know, we talk before every helicopter maneuvers or something. The pilot talks with the director or the cinematographer, where do you want it exactly? So the pilot came to us, said, standing by the camera, where do you want the helicopter? I said, right there over the canyon, you know, right there, look at the camera. He brought the helicopter right to this precise point in the viewfinder of the camera. And he was not a movie pilot, you know, he was real ex-pilot. He was a retired pilot, you know, an ex-pilot. Now, the stunt crew is a local stunt crew. The entire stunt crew was in South Africa. When I came there first with American Ninja, they had a very basic stunt crew. So we brought stunt people with us. I brought in BJ Davis from Hollywood and four stunt, and they started to train South African stunt people. We finished American Ninja 2, and the stunt, BJ Davis stayed in South Africa, and he kept training South African stunt people. By the time we came to Operation Delta Force, the American people already left. The American stunt people left, and the entire stunt crew of Operation Delta Force were South African, including all the... I saw a lot of flying when I reviewed the movie. You know, every explosion had a... flying bodies flying over fences and over flames. And those are done with ramps and all kind of cable and all kind of mechanical. And they did everything really, really well, including the guy who parachuted into the stuntman, who supposedly Natasha, but it was a stuntman who parachuted right into the camp.
We'll talk about a few of the main favorite scenes in a moment, but there's some really great stuff. And I have to mention the classic 90s suppressor sounds. Because you got all those, Rob mentioned the MP5 SD, but you had like a suppressed grease gun, and there's lots of suppressed pistols because they're special forces, so they have to have suppressed guns. But you get that classic, some of those classic suppressed sounds. And I love all the set pieces because, and close and dear to my heart, is there's a Stelling submachine gun. There's a guy running around with one of those, and there's all sorts of cool stuff.
Let me tell you, some of the stuntmen, when I was talking with them, some of them served in Angola. Some of them fighting in Angola. Okay. Some of them, not all of them. But some of the stuntmen had the military experience because they were fighting in the South African army in Angola. I don't know if they brought in some special forces by like the descending on the wall with the cable going upside down.
Oh, yeah. The running down the wall. They did
it very well, or coming out of the helicopter with the cable. So they brought in some people with military experience, but some of the stunt people themselves told me that they were in Angola fighting during the war in Angola.
What I was going to mention was the great use of water cannon at the end. I've never seen a water cannon quite like it. That was very Ali. I like that very much.
This was an improvisation on the spot because the cannon was there. The water cannon was on the ship. And, you know, I'm always looking, you know, when I direct action movies, I'm the director. Of course, many people are helping the director, especially when it comes to action, the stunt coordinator. But I always, in my mind, I always think about the audience. And our goal, my job, let's say my goal, my purpose is to excite the audience on the screen, to make it exciting so the people... So any elements that sometimes you see an element in the location, you say, wow, that might add a little bit humorous, a little bit more excitement. So the cannon was there. It's not from the script. It was just there on the ship.
It's great. I've never seen anything quite like it.
So I asked the people, is it operative? Is it working? The people who
Yeah.
Who operate the ship, the real people, not the movie people. So I said, yeah, sure, you can operate the cannon. I said, let's use it. Let's do something with it.
Right.
Let's find some of a gimmick to use the
It's
cannon.
Definitely the first time we've mentioned the water cannon.
What I really wanted, I'll tell you the truth, what I really, really wanted, but it didn't come to fruition. I wanted this whole sequence at the end to be in the rain. To have a rain, pouring rain, like I did in Avenging Force. The ending of Avenging Force is a 12 minutes in the rain action sequence. So I wanted the same thing. But it was night, it was very cold, they didn't have the rain, they couldn't arrange the rain machines. So I said, at least we'll have the water cannon.
The cannon, yeah.
That's great.
Well, I think that takes us really nicely into favorite scenes territory, and we can all talk about some of our favorite sequences from the movie. So Sam, as you're the director, do you have a favorite scene from the whole movie?
I enjoyed a lot working with the train, I'll tell you the truth. With this tall bridge and two... There is some force to it that you have two trains stand. It's a very tall bridge.
It's spectacular.
Very,
it's
you
a
know,
gorgeous
skinny
location.
Leg, standing on very skinny leg.
Yeah.
So we worked underneath and we worked above and on the roof. And I was on the roof of the train. You know, sometimes I don't want to say I take risk. I try not to take risk as a director. But still, you get some exciting moment. You know, I'm sitting on top of a train, on the roof of a train, and the train is moving on top of a bridge, and what is it, like 100 foot down to the bottom. So there are exciting moments, even as a director, when I'm trying to avoid danger. Believe me, I'm not taking risks. But there were a lot of exciting moments in this train sequence, filming from inside the helicopter, filming on top of the train, filming inside the train, and it's moving all the time. So it was nice, some new action for me, new type of directing.
Mm. No, it works really well. It's really nice to see it. I mean, for me, one of my favorite part of the movie is, well, I got all of it is really, I really enjoy this movie. But for me, one of my favorite parts is the initial assault on the bio lab by the baddies, the AFA guys. And yeah. I just love how... Like it's just they're just unashamedly bad, so that they turn up and they gun down the defenses of the bio lab, and they assault it, and they get a shot at by a pillbox, and then they take out the pillbox, and they're inside the bio lab, and they're gunning everyone down, and not taking any prisoners, and I just loved how you're just establishing them as the bad guys so well, and
Eddie Hudson gets that great life deal as well.
It's a western; you want to establish the baddies are baddies.
It is that way,
And this whole set, this whole glass was a set was built.
Oh wow!
On a soundstage, in a big warehouse in Johannesburg. So all the glasses were breakaway glasses. It was built to be destroyed. The art department, the way they build it. Was built to be destroyed, that all the glasses will explode and the whole thing will...
Yeah, it's really... No, I love it.
Go in pieces, go to hell in pieces.
Yeah, yeah, I love it. It's just unashamedly just balls to the wall action. You know, it doesn't relent, it doesn't stop. It sets up the plot of them getting the vials, and there's still a little bit of mystery of what's in that second vial. You know, it still keeps you thinking, keeps you guessing what it could be. I just really like it. Matt, what about you? Favourite scenes?
I like the intro. I like it's kind of like a fake out where they're doing the training mission at the beginning, and the guys are abseiling down the front of the building. The helicopter comes in, they breach in, and they've got the little cameras and looking under the door and stuff. It's all really cool. And then they do room clearances. I really like that bit. I also like the little bit in the village with the buggy and the it's got that rocket mounted on the roll bar, and it fires off, and it blows.
This is stolen from the Delta Force movies.
The
Delta Force movies from Chuck Norris. but I do like how we took the couple of time we took the jeeps on the air, flying in the air and landing.
That's great. The boat sequence as well. We haven't even talked about the boat sequence where there's a running battle with the little assault boats. That's quite cool as well. But
the so-called the armor part of the boat our directing. You know that it was built on a regular boat. Mm-hmm. Our directing.
Very cool.
Yeah, it was nice as well.
Hello, I'm Al Murray, and you're listening to Fighting on Film, the world's number one war film podcast.
So, I mean, maybe that brings us on to final thoughts, Matt, for this week.
I think so.
I mean, so it's been fascinating talking to you about your experiences on the film, Sam. So what are your, what's your sort of your thoughts on the movie? You're 20 years later, you know, what do you make of it now?
Well, I'll tell you, I haven't seen it for a long time, and because of our meeting, because of our podcast, I re-reviewed it, and that's the way I looked at it today. The movie, as a movie, it lacks. Something is missing here in this movie in a general, and this is the, I would say, the emotional level of storytelling which connects the audience, brings the audience to a point that they care, really care about the, what's going to happen. Now, you can sit there as I did, you can sit back in your chair and just enjoy the action. I say, I'm going to see some military action here going on and on, sure. Non-stop roller coaster of action. But in the world of movie, there is a moment that you say, okay, enough of this. Where is my emotional involvement? Where is my empathy to the story? And usually in most of cinemas and in most of stories, there is a hero. Mm. One hero that you sympathize with, one hero that you identify with, and you go with your hero, usually. Of course, there are movies like Seven Samurais or the hero is a group. It's not a hero anymore. And this is similar. This is the same idea. This is Seven Samurai. The heroes are a group of heroes together, but it doesn't draw you as well. Another thing, in movies, in cinema, there is what I call the magic element of the recipe, which is unpredictable. It's impossible to, you know, you have seen some big movies with big stars, and something doesn't, there is no chemistry, let's say, in the love story. The love story goes along on the screen, but you can feel that those two actors, they don't know, no chemistry.
Definitely seen that.
Sometimes it's amazing. So I bring as an example American Ninja. The chemistry between Michael Dudikoff and Steve James was explosive, was unbelievable. It's a magic on the screen. You cannot create it. It just happens.
Yeah, it happens, yeah.
And here in this, and that's the point. In this Operation Delta Force, where the two main characters are Ernie Hudson and Jeff Faye, I don't feel this chemistry, that this magical element, the magical spice, the magic of chemistry that happens in movies or doesn't happen, either or, you know. We have seen some huge budget movies with the chemistry is not there, the magic is not, and this chemistry is missing in Operation Delta Force. So you're right, as we, you guys, right? If we are dealing with a war movie, with a military movie, you got the good, you know. You sit there in the audience, and you see what you came to see, and it's pretty, as I told you, and it's pretty accurate because of Eric Simmel. That what we see in the screen is very pretty much accurate to what really happens in special forces, in the level of the magic of relationship, the movie lacks.
Yeah, I mean, I do agree with you there. I think, and there's not many, to be fair, there isn't many scenes where Hudson and Fahey are chatting that much. So maybe that hinders it. Maybe
the best scene is in the Hercules, in the airplane. Yeah,
that's a good one.
This is the best scene between the two of them.
And they find out that they're infected. That is good. But in terms of final thoughts for me, like We picked the Delta Force franchise just as a little bit of fun for the end of the year to take us into December, but we didn't fully know what to expect going into the first movie. And I got to admit, I watched it with my wife, and she's a massive critic. She used to work in film. She was a camera op. She was she used to do sound, and she was sitting there and she was going, yeah, it's just quite enjoyable. You know, you know what you're getting. And I think that's why I love these movies so much. As I said earlier, it's a lost art for me. These canony Globus movies, they just don't make them anymore, and I just love it. And if what a way to kick off December.
And I'll tell you one, there is one magic in those movies. And it's true to all the movies that I happen to direct, the action movies. What you see in the screen really happened. Yes. No gimmicks, no optical effects, no digital effects.
This is something that I see the eye about as well.
You see on the screen physically happened on the set.
If you think about films
every
now,
fly off a jeep, everybody who rolls down, everybody comes down the building. This is for real. No gimmicks, no optical, digital generated images, nothing. Mm.
Well,
so that's nice. You feel it as an audience. You feel there is. It's subconscious. You don't have to sit there as an audience and say, wait a second. You don't. But there is something underneath that you feel that how rough it is, real it is what you see.
That is exactly what I was going to say, because you watch films like this now and there's an over-reliance on CGI, and the CGI is often not very good because the budget isn't there. But you've made a film for $1 million and you get in a hostage rescue, boats, trains, set pieces, a bowler, a halo jump, helicopters. Everything's in there. Annie Hudson's great, despite, you know, there not being that chemistry that you've just eloquently spoken about. But I think as an action movie, I think it really does work really well. It has something to it. I really did enjoy it. You don't get that very often with this sort of film nowadays, that when people try and make these sort of films, it doesn't always quite hit the mark.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, well, the
80s and the 90s were a very good time for a low-budget independent action movies. Very good time.
Absolutely.
It was enough budget. Today, there is not enough budget for those kind of movies. And, hey, listen, I'm happy that you guys enjoyed it. And I'm happy that other viewers or other listeners that are listening now to our podcast enjoyed it or will go now and watch the movie.
I'm sure they will. So, I mean, yeah, we have to round off the episode there. Thanks very much for joining us, Sam. It's been an absolute pleasure listening to you tell us all about the making of the movie. And please do go watch Operation Delta Force if you can. It's out there on YouTube. Someone must have the rights to it. And they've uploaded them all. Do join us next week for Operation Delta Force 2 Mayday. So please do join us then. And you can catch the rest of the podcast over on fightingonfilm.com. There's nearly 160 episodes. I'm sure there'll be something in there for you to enjoy. So thanks for listening, folks. And we'll catch you next week. All that's left to say, goodbye.
Okay, goodbye. Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast. So everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.